You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Sameer Santi from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Why we need to make university free and how we can do it. Also on the program today, Mark Sanford, new congressman-elect from South Carolina. The countdown begins. When will he take his next Appalachian hiking tour? And what will happen when he does with this wife? I guess we'll see. The United States federal government, in direct reaction to a piece in Time magazine by Stephen Brill, we interviewed him on this program about it several weeks ago, has now released records indicating just how wide the disparity can be in the cost of medical services. Also on the program today, the district court judge handed down that ruling on Plan B, rips into the Obama administration for lying, diddling, and maintaining the same policy as the Bush administration. Also, hearkening back to an interview we did with Kevin Gastola on this program, an unnamed female CIA operative who ran a dark site in Thailand and helped destroy the documents and video involving the torture regime within the CIA gets passed over for head of clandestine services at the CIA. And today, I guess, is Benghazi Day for some Republicans on the Hill. Other Republicans saying, I know everything I need to know. Not sure why we're doing this. All that and more. But let's start off with this, what I think is really incredibly relevant moment in terms of both the Obama presidency and in terms of the fight to prevent a grand bargain from cutting Social Security. Ed Markey, who is the Democratic nominee for Senate in Massachusetts. Primary ended, I guess, was last week. A week ago, actually. Has sent out an email to supporters. And we have talked about this in the past for quite some time. At what point do Democrats start running against President Obama for his planned cuts to Social Security? Well, that point is today. Ed Markey, coming from a state where President Obama won a huge victory over Mitt Romney. I don't know by how many points. Was it 20 points? There, I'm sure there's a state or two where Obama did better against Mitt Romney. Off the top of my head, I can't think of it. But that's what makes this so interesting. Ed Markey, in the subject line of his email, tell Obama don't cut Social Security. He writes in his email, the president released a budget which would cut Social Security benefits for retired Americans by adopting something called a chain CPI. It's a complicated sounding name that boils down to this. Social Security benefits for seniors would be cut. You could think of CPI as meaning cutting people's income. It's a wrong-headed move. Too many seniors, almost two-thirds, in fact, rely on Social Security for at least half their income. Budgeting requires compromise, but we cannot compromise by cutting Social Security. He goes on to say, we don't need to roll over to the right wing when it comes to budget choices. We are now seeing a candidate for the Senate. And this, again, will be a special election because John Kerry is headed to the cabinet. But we have seen a candidate for the Senate in a state which went overwhelmingly for Obama, running against Obama in this election. Now, he had to do this, of course, because he had to get out in front of the Republican nominee, picking up that banner and running to protect Social Security. But this illustrates the position that Obama put Democrats running in Senate and House races across the country. And this is a great sign to see, A, that we have senators who are going to run against cutting Social Security. And B, it's also going to put a check on the White House. And in my estimation, it also creates an important distinction. A distinction between President Obama being a Democrat and President Obama being a liberal. So kudos to Ed Markey. Were I still a Massachusetts resident, he would get my vote. I mean, he would have gotten it anyways against the Republican, but
he's good.
Now I would have a little lift in my step as I entered into the voting booth. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Sameer Santi on why we need free universities in this country and how we can get to it. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Today, Senator Elizabeth Warren has introduced a bill to extend, or I should say, to drop lower the student interest rates from for 1 year from 3.4% to 0.75%. For student loans for higher education. We know that within a couple of months, the loan rate will double to 6.8%. Our next guest will talk to us about why that very well may be missing the point. I imagine we all think it's a good thing, but On the phone, I have Samir Santi. He is a graduate student from the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is a member of the TA Union system-wide and also a contributor to Jacobin. He has written a piece on nonsite.org, going back to class, why we need to make university free and how we can do it. Samir, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So, all right, Samir, let's start with Peter Drucker. You start your piece by talking about him and his perspective on us. Who was he, and what? Why start with him?
So, Peter Drucker was a he's now considered sort of the father of management science, sort of what all undergraduate and MBA students, in business schools across the country learn when they take their introductory management courses. He was pretty influential in sort of theorizing the science of management in the mid-20th century. He spent a little bit of time with General Motors writing a book about the corporation. And I think that was in the 50s. He's basically, sort of given his academic, he sat at MIT for a while, given his academic and sort of his professional, activity. He's not someone you would think of as an advocate of an expanded public sector, especially sort of in the day and age we live in today. You're not hearing too many corporate executives talking about expanding the public sector. It's mostly about cutting it. But he was known, and from the 60s on, he was a big advocate of expanding higher education and access to higher education, making sure students of all income backgrounds could go to college, because he sort of believed that the U.S. was entering in the late 20th century a knowledge economy, sort of moving past the industrial peak, and that education for young people was going to be central. So he was actually an advocate of the state sort of paying for everyone to go to college. And this is a guy who, who's not a friend of trade unions, not a friend of the left by any stretch of the imagination. But I just thought it's so striking how much things have changed in the past 50 years that we got a guy who was pretty much the thinker for modern managers, advocating free higher ed. So that's sort of why I started with that in the piece.
And there's really two arguments that run parallel in this argument that universities should be free. And that is, one, this perspective of a member of the corporate class, if you will, who's saying that just in terms of society, from a practical standpoint, it makes much more sense. There's also the argument that you make, in almost in some respects, simply just state as a stipulate that by its very nature, we want a citizenry that is educated.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think sort of the main or the underlying argument I want to make here is that higher education, education generally, shouldn't be about training young people for the workforce. It shouldn't be about human capital advancement. It ought to be about having an educated citizenry that can make serious decisions, think about politics in a serious way, and that has the opportunity to learn for the sake of learning. We've got so many incredible people on campuses all across the country, and it's really a tragedy that more young people aren't able to sort of just go and study what they want. And I guess, that sort of links to, my experience teaching on campus. We see so many young people going into majors and studying things that they feel are going to prepare them to get a job to pay off their student loans. And that's not what education ought to be about. Enrollment in the humanities is dropping, which is, a pretty big reflection of that. And we see more and more kids majoring in finance and economics. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with them doing that, but I don't think that most of those decisions are made out of intellectual interest. It's, I think, more sort of material imperative.
Yeah, I mean, it's I asked that because on this program we tend to have a lot of libertarian callers call in, and they simply do not accept that notion. And maybe this is sort of where it's one of those things where there's not necessarily a perfect argument to make. It's one of those things that people see they either take as a tenant of society or not, that we should have an educated citizenry for the sake of having them educated, as opposed to be measured in terms of dollars. I just wanted to mention that because that's something that sort of you stipulate early in your piece, and it certainly for many of us it's a perfectly reasonable stipulation. But I wanted to point that out, and you also sort of you add that notion of there's also sort of these those people who may not stipulate it simply for the sake of society, but for the sake of the citizens, but for the sake of the broader society. So let's talk about why we now see such high debt and what has happened to the education system over the past three decades or so.
So yeah, I mean the origins of student debt really go back to the 1970s. There was a major economic crisis in the 70s, and that's sort of when austerity, as we now understand it, really arrived in the U.S. New York City's had a major fiscal crisis in the middle of that decade, and across the country, state budgets started getting slashed. And really, I mean, basically, there's two ways that college is paid for, right? It's either the state contributes resources, or the individual, the student or their family, pays for it. So as state funding started to drop in the 1970s and really, really picked up, it was sort of a precipitous decline through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but in the 2000s, it just plummeted. And so as that happened, then, the students had to pick up the burden. And the other side of that coin is that during that period, household income completely stagnated. We haven't seen a real increase in wages basically at all since the 1970s. I believe since 1973, real household income has risen about 10%. And during the post-war boom from 1945 through 1973, real household income rose at about 2.7% per year, which works out to basically during that post-war boom, real household income was rising in 2 years what it's risen over the past 40 years. So that's sort of the story right there. Wages just completely stopped rising, and state support for higher ed plummeted. So the solution is debt. That's where this all comes from. This is not really a new thing. It's been going on for about 40 years now.
And I would add that the studies that I have looked at in this question have shown that as state colleges, state universities rose their tuition rates, it created upward pressure on the university system wide. And inflated the prices of higher education across the board, because as the lowest cost option rose in price, so did the higher cost options. And so it's sort of a perfect storm, as it were, in terms of making college inaccessible. And to the extent that it made it accessible, it made it it limited people's options once they got there. So let's talk about what it would take. I mean, presuming that we're all starting from the same place of that we want to encourage more people to go to experience higher education, to become educated, and also to have more freedom within the context of that to pursue studies that don't necessarily have an explicit return on investment as it's measured. Generally now across society, why is that important? How do we get there?
Well, so, I think this sort of will take us back a bit to your previous point about libertarian, sort of the libertarian line on, and sort of the fault lines on this question about whether everyone ought to be able to go to college, period. And I think there we see it sort of as a class question, really. Part of it is about values, right? I mean, I believe that everyone ought to go to college, but part of it is about who can go and who can't. And so typically the people you hear making that argument that, maybe not everyone should be going to college, or if you can't afford it, you can't go, those are people who either have been to college or whose kids are going to college. They're not the ones who are worrying about it. And so it's condescending, and it's sort of betraying their class privilege to begin with. So I think that's sort of where we need to start about understanding this issue. In order to make it all work, we could make college free for everyone for about 4% of the federal budget, which is about a quarter of what we already spend on defense. Right now, the average state spends about 6.6% of its budget on higher ed expenses. The federal government could relieve all of that and relieve all tuition and fees for all students at about 4% of their budget. So as a percentage of the budget, the federal government can make college free for less than what your average state is already doing. So it's really, I mean, it's sort of a rounding error on the federal budget. It's laughably inexpensive. And I mean, as far as, you know, if we want to think about, if we want to use sort of their language of return on investment, we have an example to draw on, which is the GI Bill, which after World War II sent 8 million veterans back to college for free, gave them a living stipend. And 40% of people who used it said they wouldn't have gotten to college otherwise. And in 1987, about 40 years after it was passed, the Congressional Budget Office released a study that said for every $1 the federal government spent on the GI Bill, they got a return of $7 in tax revenue from the productivity and income gains it generated. So, I mean, that's a pretty good return on investment by, I think, any business person standard. Not that that's how I want to measure the value of college, but I think, you know, free higher ed would not only be great because it would let everyone go to college, but it would also stimulate the economy tremendously. Construction would go up on campus, commercial development around campuses, hiring of faculty and staff. It would be a real boost to the economy. And sort of on that note, I just saw yesterday, actually, I think the Brookings Institution put out a study that said austerity since the crisis started in 2007, 2008 has cost the U.S. economy about 2.2 million jobs. Part of that is so about 500,000 jobs have been completely cut by state, local, state and federal governments. But the other side of that coin is that every recession since 1970 until this one, the government increased their public sector employment by about an average of 1.7 million per recession. So the net difference here, since we've been cutting rather than adding, is about 2.2 million. So if we a program like free public higher ed would actually be a real stimulus for the economy beyond its you know humanistic and sort of emancipatory liberatory effects.
Yes, and those past recessions include under Reagan, under George W. Bush, every single president who has had an administration during the wake of a recession has increased the number of government workers without exception. And we should also add that when you talk about those 40% who wouldn't have otherwise been able to go to college, the lack of debt probably also freed up the other 60% to pursue where their interests lie. And we should also, I would also add that while I don't think there's necessarily a structural problem in terms of this unemployment, it's more cyclical. To the extent that there's any evidence that it's structural, having a college, having an education, whether you've been studying poetry or whether you've been studying engineering, it teaches you to learn. And when you talk about retraining workers or trying to create some type of flexibility within a workforce and its ability to deal with changing economies, that gives you, I don't know how one would measure that, but certainly the capacity to learn at that level has got to help you in the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's impossible to measure but the impact that the critical thinking development that occurs and just the socialization, meeting people you'd never otherwise have met, getting exposed to different kinds of people, different kinds of ideas, those pay benefits that we can never measure, but they're important ones for sure.
Now, when you talk about how to get to this place, I mean, that's why you very quickly dismiss the idea of a legislative or at least starting from a legislative process, which is, you know, in part why I mentioned Senator Warren's proposal here. And it continues to follow this model of let's allow students get into debt. It'll just be a little bit less debt going forward. But you talk about the need for a movement, and this brings you back to trade unions. Why focus on trade unions when the perception is they're at their, and it's not just a perception, I mean, just in terms of sheer numbers, they're at their lowest ebb in terms of political power over the past 70 some odd years?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess this sort of goes back. I'm sort of the dismissal of legislation goes back to, I think, what you were talking about right before I came on about Obama's proposal to cut Social Security. So, I mean, we're in a moment now, a historical moment where a Democratic president is proposing cuts to Social Security. That would have been unthinkable even 5 years ago. So clearly, right now, today, legislation that's going to seriously expand the public sector is out of the question. There's no way that that's going to happen today. it's naive at best to think otherwise. But that doesn't mean that over time that political center of gravity can't be shifted. And I think that's how we need to think about this thing as a longer-term project. And so sort of in that spirit is where I raise the trade union point. For one, historically, unions have been at the center of basically every progressive achievement that's worth mentioning over the past 150 or so years. I mean, they were back in the middle 19th century. They were behind, in many ways, the universalization of public primary education. Obviously, the eight-hour day, which May 1st just happened, sort of commemorating the long struggle for the eight-hour day, child labor laws, minimum wage, all the way even through civil rights. Sort of a part of that story that's often omitted is the role that trade unions played in sort of advancing the civil rights struggle. Sort of an interesting story there is that Martin Luther King was actually recruited by trade unionists in Montgomery to speak on behalf of the bus boycott there in 1955. He wasn't even the first minister they actually called on. I think he's the third. But the point being that the unions have been central to basically all progressive struggles since industrial capitalism emerged in this country, and there's really no reason to believe we can do much serious activism without them. So now onto the point of, you know, sort of the decline of the labor movement. That's, I mean, when we think about inequality, that's the way inequality has risen in the last 40 years. I think, you know, there's a direct correlation, an inverse correlation with the rise of inequality and the fall of the labor movement. Study came out a couple of years ago that said since 1973, union memberships plummeted by 75% and inequality has risen by 40% over that same period. So, And I do very much think that this crisis in higher ed, as I noted with the stagnating household wages, is about inequality as much as anything else. So we are going to need to strengthen and revitalize the trade union movement to do anything, really. That's sort of one point. But that, putting that aside, even at its low point right now, you know, unions represent 12% of the workforce. It's the lowest in a century. That's still 14 million workers. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at. And if we could get 5% of that activated in a cause like this, that's close to a million organized workers with all the resources that come with the organization. And that could be a start, you know. That's not nothing.
Well, you cite the Chicago teachers' strike. Talk to us about that, because, you know, this is something that at the time I was following quite a bit, and it was fascinating to me to sort of juxtapose what the Chicago Teachers Union did versus, say, what the unions were doing in the battle in Wisconsin. Just talk a little bit about that, because the reporting you did on that fight, I think, was sort of what I had intuited from talking to people who were involved in that strike.
Right. So, part of the reason the Chicago struggle is so important, not only is it one of the biggest, you know, the third biggest city, the third biggest school district in the country, but it's also sort of ground zero of what's going on in public education nationally right now. Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, came out of the Chicago public school system. Rahm Emanuel is the mayor. He's, you know, obviously Obama's right-hand man through the first term. So, It is an important site of sort of the struggle. And what's going on with public education, with sort of the attacks, the cuts, school closures, charterization of public schools, most teachers' unions across the country are giving concessions, are sort of trying to salvage what they've got and basically maintain some fundamental dignity. And that's understandable given sort of the scale and intensity of the attack. But what's remarkable about what happened in Chicago is that the teachers union there took on the offensive. And so in 2010, a caucus of pretty visionary leaders, one power in the local, they're called the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, really committed to sort of activating the membership, educating the membership about the roots of the crisis. They spent about 5 years doing this. I mean, this strike didn't just happen overnight. It was built over a long time of serious grassroots organizing amongst both teachers, parents, community members. And they came out, and, you know, the strike wasn't just about wages and basic seniority privileges, which these things often are. It was about class size, school closures, nutritious meals, world languages, all kinds of things that are really, you know, beyond just the teachers' wallets and pocketbooks. And I think that's why I met such incredible support and was able to take on this establishment that seemed sort of invincible at the outset. And I think sort of the model that they did is going on the offensive, not just being on the defensive. And they proved that even in a really adverse environment, going on the offensive can be successful. And so I think that's a real inspiring lesson for us to learn.
And I would add that, you know, what's key here is that their organizing started through almost 3 years, or at least, you know, the sort of the direct line you can draw almost is 3 years out from when they took their action and they built their relationships. And this is what I think is so important. And this is, but it also raises an important question in the context of building a movement for free higher education, is that they were able to communicate, like you say, their fight and to relate their fight and sort of get the parents and the broader community to be invested in their fight. They became the vanguard of a movement within the community rather than simply arguing for their own narrow interests. And so the question here, and it's obviously when you're talking about elementary school teachers and when you're talking about middle and high school teachers, there's a different relationship with the community they're serving than, say, other trade unions, because, you know, parents want to support their teachers and want feedback from their teachers in the course of daily existence, because these people are taking care of their kids. How do you build that relationship with a wide array of unions with their broader community? I mean, you know, it's one thing to say that I'm in the sanitation workers union, and you folks, speaking to the average citizen, you need me, and I help. It's not just about my wages; it's about also keeping your communities clean. And I mean, so, how is that? How is those relationships built? And also, in the context of a free education, I mean, where is the value to the members of the union and to the broader community in this fight?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a really good question. I think, and in this sense, it's sort of worth thinking about a curse as something of a blessing. You know, union membership has been plummeting for several years, but one stronghold, and we've seen this in Wisconsin and Ohio and all over the places, is the public sector, right? That's where the vast majority of union members now are. Public sector unionization across the country is still above 30%, whereas it's below 7% in the private sector. And the thing about the public sector is, you know, they serve the public. So I think that public sector unions, like teachers, like sanitation workers, nurses, all the rest of them, have sort of are uniquely positioned to convey that their interests are aligned with the broader public's interests. And this is a perfect, I mean, free higher ed is a perfect example of how the labor movement more broadly can get behind that to show that you know, the labor organizing workers on campuses and in schools across the country isn't just about the workers, right? It's about a public good, a social right that everyone ought to have access to. So I think one of the sort of, if we can find a diamond here in this nasty situation that we're in, is that public sector is what we've got left. And I think that there's a lot of room to build community alliances from the workers in public sector jobs and the broader community.
Yeah. And then I guess, you know, from a public sector worker, I mean, you're going to have a public university. There's going to be some measure of you know, direct payoff, I guess. So it's sort of like working both those ends to it. Where in the country, I mean, to the extent, and maybe the answer is nowhere, but to the extent that there is any of this agenda bubbling up anywhere in the country, I mean, where do you see it? I mean, because I have spent a lot of time in various outlets arguing with the libertarian types who are telling me that there's a problem with creating a debt bubble with students, and where we should not have the government backstopping any loans or providing any low-cost loans. And to a certain extent, well, I agree. But the real answer at that point is go back to the system of free education that we had in this country at various times. Where else do you see this bubbling up? I mean, are there any type of sort of flashpoints or across the country? Are there any type of organizations that you see that this movement is beginning to grow in some measure?
Right. Well, the one big one, and it's just outside the U.S., but in Quebec last year, there was a major, major student movement around the issue of free higher education. The provincial government there proposed an increase in tuition, which by our standards wouldn't seem like a lot, but by Quebec standards was quite substantial. And the students there went on strike, not demanding just that tuition proposal be retracted, but that higher education in the province be made free. And it was a long sort of grinding strike, but they came out on top, and the province retracted the proposal. And so, you know, it's unclear where that's going to go going forward, but it was a pretty remarkable victory, and I think, you know, an educational experience for a lot of the people that were active in it. In the U.S., you know, you're right, the landscape isn't great. It's tough to sort of identify a specific thing that we can really latch onto in public higher ed. But I mean, I think like things like the Chicago teacher strike, the struggles that are happening in K-12 schools across school districts across the country, and I mean, in a lot of ways, I think graduate student unions, unions of adjunct faculty who are sort of contingent laborers, they're sort of seeds, I think, of where this movement might come from. But yeah, we got a long way to go, I think, before I can say anything too optimistic.
I think you're right about those teachers unions. I mean, at least, you know, in the graduate student unions. I mean, it sounds somewhat fanciful, but they are the ones who essentially started what happened in Wisconsin in terms of the strikes from University of Madison. And it seems to me that is the sort of the most logical place for this to happen on a national level, because you have people there who clearly appreciate the value of higher education, and also simultaneously are not necessarily reaping financial, enormous amounts of financial rewards from it, but yet they still value that education, and they seem to be, if that coalition where teachers unions can be marching with, welders and other unions across the spectrum, I think that we might just see something happen on this front.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, graduate students, adjunct faculty, even tenured faculty, you know, they didn't go into this for the money, obviously. And they have the most direct interaction with students. And so I think it is really, that's sort of one of those strategic points where you might be able to build a student, you know, an academic worker coalition in a serious way.
Well, Sameer Santi, I appreciate your coming on and talking about it. We're going to link to your piece on majority.fm. I encourage everybody to go and read it. It's a very well-written piece, and I think it's an increasingly important point. I mean, at one point, we need to form a beachhead this is not just simply about the idea of higher education. It's also about the idea of society seeing value in government actually doing something for society at large that does not necessarily have, first and foremost, a bottom line to it. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
All right,
thanks,
folks.
Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate you having me.
We're going to take a break and come back in the better half of the program, wherein, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Huckabee has found what he believes could be the key. And I feel like I say this every day, but it's just a different guy. It's Alex Jones has found the key. Glenn Beck has found the key. Mike Huckabee has found the key. They've all found the key to unlock the mystery of what will happen. We will talk about that in the better half of the program. Also, my analysis, be that as it may, of the Sanford race beating Colbert Bush in South Carolina. Also, this amazing, I don't know if I've seen a judge from the bench really eviscerate an administration like this before. And this guy is a Reagan appointee and disparaging the Obama administration by saying you just like Bush on this issue. Also, we will talk about this release of the records in which we see how disparate the prices are that hospitals charge, not just across the country for the exact same procedure, but even across a metropolitan area. And the story of the former head of a CIA black site, apparently it's not good on your resume in John Brennan's CIA, which I guess hope springs eternal. And we will get to that story of the Air Force officer who is in charge of dealing with sexual assault in the Air Force being charged with sexual assault. And like I said yesterday, good for him for not doing it during work hours, because that would be really bad. Please take that with the facetiousness it was meant. All right, folks, you can support this program, and we certainly do need your support badly, at majority.fm. If you're not a member, you don't have to do it for the extra 50 minutes you get a day. You don't have to do it for the DVDs that we offer that are worth, in many respects, you know, half a year's membership practically. Some would say they're priceless. Just do it to support this program, to make sure that we're able to do it day in, day out, mostly, and to raise the caliber of the programming. That, in and of itself, should be enough. And, of course, you can also support the program by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Use our Amazon link. You can find it at majority.fm. Support the show. If you want to just do a one-off donation, you can find that at the Support the Show page. You don't want to have to deal with, monthly membership. Just hit the donate button if you want.
At the very least, subscribe to our YouTube channel.
That's even beyond least.
That's beyond least. That's even below it.
That's almost less than you could do, at least. All right, folks. Call the program, 646-257-3920. If you're a libertarian, you want to call me, you want to tell me, hey, we shouldn't have college for everybody, or we shouldn't provide free access to college for everybody. Because, you know, some people are born with it, some people aren't. And it would be interesting, because every time we've heard that argument, it has been from somebody who's been in college. And I think the last guy who made that argument was actually in a state college.
The last two people that we had that type of argument with were both state college people.
Yeah. Nothing like shutting the door once you're in. But whether you're in college or not, whether you've attended university or not, whether or not you anticipate being able to go because your parents are going to pay for you or not, give us a call. We always love to hear from libertarians. In fact, let's open up another line. 646-257-3920 for libertarians. 646-257-3920. Feel free to call us on your completely privatized sat phone from a privatized satellite in the sky. And or you can IM the show at Majority IFM on that that privatized intranet that you were able to build through your through that garbage scow that is off the coast of the United States in international waters. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in just a moment.